You're listening to the Charlottesville Podcasting Network at SeavillePodcast.com. Lectures, radio shows, and more are available on demand at SeavillePodcast.com. Now available through email. Sign up on our homepage. I'm Dan Daniels. Panelists Donna Goings, Robert Graham, and David Shreve examined the problems with today's healthcare system, their origins, and how they would be addressed by a proposed national health insurance program. The panel included the perspectives of a patient, a medical professional, and an economist. They spoke at the June 10, 2009 meeting of the Senior Statesmen of Virginia, held at the Charlottesville Senior Center. Our podcast is entitled Health Insurance, The Problem, The Solution. Following the presentation, questions were taken from the audience. Today's program was moderated by SSV member Bob McAdams.
Good afternoon to all of you. What our topic is today is health insurance, the problems, and the solution, or one possible solution. What we are here is representatives of a local group, a kind of an ad hoc committee that was formed after a forum that was held at the county office building on health insurance last February. All of us who attended that forum felt that, whoa, there's a lot of information here. There's a lot of different points of view. We need more information. And some of the information that we received that night needs to be broadcast broadly in the community so that we can all have an informed discussion of health insurance, health care, and what our needs are and how to meet them. So we decided to meet informally, and we gathered together a couple of weeks afterwards. While I was sitting at the table where a group of almost 20 people had gathered, I realized the wide diversity of perspectives that are in our group, that are represented by members of our community. And we began to figure out ways to get messages from those different perspectives out to the public. Being a longtime member of Senior Statesmen, I immediately turned to Marvin and said, hey, how about us? And they agreed that we could put this program on today. It is absolutely timely. Health care and health insurance is the primary debate that's taking place in Congress now. President Obama has made it his priority to get something done this year. And there's a lot of information that's going out. The program that we have for you today is based on these multiple perspectives. We have three panelists. If you've got your newsletter, if you saw your newsletter, you see all of their credentials. But we're looking at this from expanding points of view. Donna Goings, on the far end of the panel here, represents a self-employed person who has to get health insurance as an individual, not through a group policy, and is a patient who has to deal with the health insurance companies directly. Robert Graham, in the middle, has been with the Department of Ophthalmology at the University of Virginia Medical Center for 10 years, and he's dealing in patient billing. And he is well aware of all the complexities and all the hidden information that you don't normally see simply as a patient, but that is part of our current non-system. David Shreve, here on this side of the panel, is an economist who has been involved in many studies of health insurance and the costs of providing medical care, both for the state of Louisiana and for other governments. What we're going to do is each panelist will make a brief statement from their point of view. And then we will open the floor for questions from you. Now, the panelists and I myself have provided information. There is a card table near the entrance to this room. We have additional information that you can look at. There was one member of our committee who could not be here today. His name is Joe Mason. He's a medical doctor and psychiatrist. He has patients that he has to tend to, so he can't come to afternoon meetings. So he provided a statement from his perspective. That is on the table. And Donna has a sign-up sheet for anyone who would like to become more involved in exploring the questions of health insurance and also in helping to disseminate the information. So we have those things in the back table. Now, I think because of my advancing age, I was given the task of doing a brief review of the history, figuring I would have more history to talk about, of health insurance in the U.S. And we've been distributing that brief chronology. And it's enlightening in some respects. Before the early 20th century, medical care was provided in the home or possibly at the doctor's office. It wasn't until the second decade of the 20th century that real standardization of medical care and professional licensure became in the forefront. The American College of Surgeons was formed in the 1900 teens, and they began to require real educational and practice requirements for their members. Hospitals began to be used for treatment much more so by the end of the 1920s. During the Depression, when hospitals were struggling, as everyone else was, to be paid, and when patients were struggling to pay hospitals, you had the formation of prepayment plans. And that evolved in the mid-1930s into Blue Cross. I remember Blue Cross from when I was a child. These were nonprofit, community-based hospitalization plans that allowed you to pay a certain amount each month, and that would give you health care through those community hospitals. The doctors were much slower to pick up on this. They didn't start involving themselves together in a prepaid plan until the mid-40s, and then they developed Blue Shield. And those nonprofits enjoyed certain exemptions that insurance companies were required to have in terms of assets, and also they were tax exempt. And they began to prosper. The important point to note is that the premiums charged by these nonprofit plans were community rated, which meant that everyone who subscribed to the plan was charged the same amount, and there could be no differentials or exclusions because of health history. Now, by the mid-1940s, private insurance companies began to notice that a lot of people were subscribing, particularly through employer-based plans, but they had a different way of determining premiums. Their premiums were determined by experience-based rating. Experience-based rating allowed them to charge more, in some cases much more, for people with health histories that indicated that they were going to be a heavier cost to the insurer. Over the 40s and 50s, there was an attempt when Social Security was being formed to have a national health insurance plan. Harry Truman supported a plan in 1949 that failed to pass Congress for national health insurance. And during the 50s, the private health insurance companies systematically undercut the premiums charged by the nonprofit Blue Cross and Blue Shield and gained ever-increasing market share of the insurance health insurance market. Employers would be attracted by the lower premium rates charged by the private insurers, and they would be more profitable because they could exclude people who were sick. I mean, why write health insurance policies for people who need it? You know, instead, you would have health insurance for able-bodied people who are employed and they're being paid through their employer. These practices continued in the late 1960s. Medicare was started, and that isolated a group of people, the elderly, who, one, were probably on pensions and no longer employed, and two, were much more likely to be sick, much more likely to incur costs. Part A and Part B were instituted then. Health maintenance organizations that had originally begun with Henry J. Kaiser and the Kaiser Group were enabled by legislation in 1973 that created the potential for health maintenance organizations to exclude coverage for people, physicians who were not on their staff or who had not contracted with the health maintenance organization. And those practices led into the preferred provider networks that most plans use now, where you have some providers are covered and others are not. In a closed system, you can't get coverage for someone outside of your provider list. More recently, in 2000s, you have the Medicare Part D prescription plan, which is this strange, bizarre combination of public and private entities with this unreasonable limit on benefits to be paid dependent on how much pharmaceuticals you need during the year, so that if you need more than $2,000, you lose your coverage, and then it comes back on again later. You have to switch from one plan to another dependent on the drugs that you need. It is just bizarre. Included in that were additional subsidies for the health insurance companies and provisions that forbade the government from negotiating with pharmaceutical companies for better prices for drugs. That brings us up to the present, and the last item in our chronology is today and our little meeting here. What we'll do is we'll begin from the perspective of the consumer patient, and Donna Goings will be speaking on that. Donna?
Thank you all for letting us come. I always like to explain why I have gotten involved with this issue. I'm 62 years old. I have been self-employed for 24 years, so I've taken care of my own insurance. I always shopped around to get the lowest premium, have a huge deductible, $5,000, and I, until last year, was the insurance company's dream. I never filed a claim until last year. That's one claim in 24 years. But what happened? Had a little pimple come up here. Looked a little strange, didn't pay much attention to it, because I'm not one to run to the doctor because I'm paying the bills. And I was like, that doesn't look right. A friend of mine who's a nurse says, Donna, you really need to get somebody to look at that. Well, as it turned out, it was a squamous cell carcinoma. A skin cancer, if not treated in time, will spread over your entire body and can kill you. So, of course, they very quickly lined up surgery, like within a week. This was not something that they wanted to wait on. And it's a procedure called Mohs surgery. And you don't have to be put to sleep. You don't spend the night. You go to the doctor's office. Well, my particular one was the worst case scenario, and they had to cut four different times. It was very deep. And she had told me, and I didn't pay much attention, that if it was the worst case, that she had a plastic surgeon at UVA lined up who would do the closing. Well, naive me, I thought I'd leave there at 4 o'clock in the afternoon, have a friend pick me up, go over, hop up on the table, get sewed up, and go home. No. Had to have an operating room the next day, be put to sleep, and you know, have it fixed. I never spent the night in the hospital, but from those 48 hours, the bills came close to $10,000. And all of a sudden, I started paying attention to how the healthcare system works. And I realized that for years, I never even, you know, if I went to the doctor, I didn't even mention insurance because I was going to pay for it myself. What I've learned is I paid more all of those years than I owed because the health insurance companies have negotiated a different rate. So what I have discovered is that uninsured people are paying more than people with insurance for the exact same service. When I realized, and I had another issue last year and had trouble getting an appointment with an ENT person, had to call a doctor to go pay for that visit to get an appointment with another doctor in a timely manner, that seemed out of whack to me. And all of a sudden, I realized this healthcare system doesn't work. Last year, out of my pocket, not counting what the insurance company paid, for my health insurance premiums, I spent $10,433. That's a lot of money. And what occurred to me in all of this, what if I had no insurance that picked up after my deductible? What do those people do in America that don't have any insurance? What if I were paying for a family plan? And I really started looking at this issue, and I have discovered that, yes, we do not have the best healthcare system in the world. We may have the best doctors, but we don't have a delivery system that works. This system is in deep trouble. I am a person who has resources. I had my $5,000 deductible in a separate account because I've looked out for mine. And just think, if I hadn't been insured. The second example, and again, I suppose I'm the stories part of this panel, I have an acquaintance here who has been fighting cancer and is in remission right now. And last year when I saw her, you know, the bald head, the whole bit, she's been through it, and Lucky is a cancer survivor. And the last time I saw her, because it's not a close friend, I know her professionally, I said, "How are you doing?" She said, "I am doing really well." She works full time, she has insurance. She said, "But I am so close to that $1 million limit in my insurance policy. If I have another occurrence, I don't know what I'm going to do." It's going to be all out of her pocket. What is she going to do? She works, she has insurance, but she's getting close to that $1 million limit. Most people don't even realize they have a $1 million lifetime limit. Now, most of you my age or older in here know $1 million used to be big. But if somebody can run up a $10,000 bill in less than 48 hours and didn't even spend the night in the hospital, you know, $1 million is nothing if you're really quite sick. So all of this came home to me, and I started looking at the issue, and I decided to commit any extra time that I have to working on the issue, studying it, and I have come to the conclusion that the single payer answer is the only answer that's going to work. I will say it out loud to anyone, and I will talk to you until the cows come home about why insurance companies who are in business for profit should not be running our healthcare system. The other two people on the panel have different things to say, and we welcome questions, but my story is just one of millions in this country.
The next panelist is Robert Graham, and he'll speak from the point of view of a provider of healthcare services.
Good afternoon. Glad to be here. Just to let you know, I have long experience in my family with healthcare, as my grandfather was a small town doctor in Gainesville, Florida. Back in the 1920s, and when his daughter was going to get married, her mother took her into the kitchen and said, "We need to have the talk." And my mother thought, "Oh no, here it comes." My grandmother said, "You're marrying a minister. A lot of people are going to pay you in chickens, so you need to know how to cut up a chicken." So that was her talk. My grandfather was paid with many chickens and eggs. He was an obstetrician. So I have uncles that are physicians. I've really seen it from all sides. I try to see it from the side of the patient and the physician and everybody. You'll really need, if you want to follow what I'm saying, to look at this piece of paper. I have put 95 of them on the back thing there. On one side it says the top 12 Medicare Part B costs, and on the other side it says insurance premiums. What I'd like to do is just give you a quick rundown as to how I see charges going through the system, both for Medicare and commercial insurance, and what the differences are. So if you look at this top 12 Medicare Part B payments, those are the top services out of a list of 200 from 2007. And the very top code you'll see is 99213, which is a return office visit, level 3. And you can see that Medicare paid $6 billion, $47 million, $833,951 for this. They paid over 104 million of these office visits, and that the average price was $57.96. So the first thing I'd like you to really look at on this is that anybody who's talking about health care can throw big numbers at you and scare you. But the fact of the matter is that if they're talking about $6 billion or however many billions of dollars, Medicare alone is already spending this just for office visits. So Medicare is a huge system, and it's much bigger numbers than anybody's used to thinking about. The two codes that I have starred are codes that the ophthalmology department bills on a regular basis, the 99213 and the 66984, which is a cataract surgery. Another thing that I'd like you to look at is, it's kind of interesting, I thought, as I looked over this list, I thought that a lot of the expense would be for surgical procedures, but cataract surgery is the only surgery in the top 29 codes in terms of what Medicare is paying for. Medicare is mostly paying for office visits. Number 4 is cataract surgery. Well, everybody, if you live long enough, you're going to need cataract surgery in both eyes. But the next highest surgical procedure is this down here at the bottom, number 30, for a knee replacement. And then if you just look at the total amounts paid, you can see that of the top 10, there's a pretty quick drop-off. The first one is $6 billion, the next one is $5 billion, $3 billion, $2 billion. By the time you get to number 10, you're not even spending $1 billion on it, and this list goes all the way down to 200. So a lot of what they're paying for is just straight office visits and medical care. You know, when you go in the hospital, the doctor sees you. So now I'd like you to see how those charges go through Medicare versus how they go through a commercial insurance. So right underneath this, you'll see an example of Medicare paying for 99213. Now, at University of Virginia, the charge would be $107 for that, and it's across the university. Medicare's allowance for that charge is $59.37. So no more than $59.37 is paid for that service. The rest is written off as a contractual adjustment. Medicare pays 80%, which is $47.50, and the patient is left with a bill of $11.87. Okay? So that's how Medicare does it. Now let's compare that $107 charge with a $59.37 allowance to Aetna, Anthem, Cigna, Southern Health, and United Healthcare. And these were all the plans that I could quickly find, okay? And each of those is represented in the next column down, although I didn't identify them because it's really proprietary information. Anthem doesn't want you to know what their allowance is for the University of Virginia, and Aetna doesn't want you. So these are not in alphabetical order. I just put them in the order of who pays the least and who pays the most. So again, you have a charge of $107. The allowance for the first one is $81.35. Now, frequently they will pay a portion of that, and the patient might have a $15 copay. And if you look over here, you'll see that their allowance of $81.35 is 37% higher than the Medicare allowance. So for even the least expensive commercial insurance, whoever's paying is going to have to pay 37% more than if you had Medicare. Okay. The second, you can see that these allowances get progressively higher. They go from $81.35 as the low to $101.01, which is 70% more than Medicare. So if you're thinking, well, how can we control health care costs? Would you rather control them with a $59.37 allowance or a $101 allowance? Well, you'll achieve much greater control of costs if everybody has some type of a Medicare plan. Part of this is because the larger the group you have, the lower the price. Medicare has a very large group, and I heard just on the news the other day that some senators are saying, well, we'll maybe allow a public plan, but we won't allow them to use the Medicare guidelines because we want them to compete fairly with the commercial insurances. Well, why do you want to compete with the commercial insurances, which cost a lot more? I mean, who's speaking on behalf of the patients? I have not yet heard anybody speaking on behalf of the patients in the mainstream media, so I just want you all to see how Medicare compares with five or six different commercial insurances. And it's very easy to see how much more you'd pay with any of those commercial insurances. Notice that even with the 20% copay, Medicare's patient payment of $11.87 beats any of the commercial insurances' copays, which range from $15 to $30 to $40, depending on the plan. So Medicare does control costs, and the patient is responsible for a portion of those controlled costs. And the thing that I see the strongest about Medicare is it really commands that a reasonable price be paid for the medical services provided. Okay, now we'll look at example two, which is cataract surgery. It's the number four highest paid surgery for Medicare. And this is just the charge for the physician. Okay, the physician typically will charge $2,100 for this service. The Medicare allowance is $619.36. Whoa, that's a savings. That's a huge savings. Medicare pays close to $500, and the patient is expected to pay $123.87. Okay, $123 out of $2,100 charge. The commercial insurances are right next to it. And again, you see five different allowances. The least expensive allowance was 46% higher than Medicare. So if you want to be saved from a government medical plan, you're saying that you want to be saved so that you can pay 47% more to a commercial insurance, because these are this year's allowances. This is what people will be paying. Now, whether you pay it at the time of service as part of your deductible or whether you pay a higher premium and they pay it all up front is really just flipping the cards. The real question is, what was the allowance that they negotiated with the healthcare provider to pay for that service? I kind of like the Medicare allowance myself. The thing about Medicare is it's more than Medicare wants to pay and less than the doctor wants to receive, and that seems to be about a pretty good balance. You know, neither side is really happy, but both sides can live with it. And the other thing that I think I would like to point out about Medicare is that all the physician groups have societies. There's the American Society of Ophthalmology, American Society of Neurosurgery. All of these societies can negotiate with Medicare to change a price if they feel it's unfair. And they do that, and they have done it over the past several years. Each year, the past couple of years, Medicare was slated to get a reduction in their allowances. And each year, the societies were able to go and convince Medicare and Congress, we can't go any lower. And Congress decided not to make those cuts. So you get a tremendous benefit when you have one society or a group of societies negotiating a price with the government on a national basis, as opposed to our physicians trying to negotiate a price with 17 different insurance companies, and then those same insurance companies going over to Martha Jefferson negotiating another contract. How many contracts need to be negotiated? You know, 5,000 contracts or just one contract at a national level? And I've seen examples where Medicare will do exhaustive studies to try to determine the correct price to pay based on the expenses that the doctors have to run their practice. So I have high confidence that Medicare can come up with a fair price. Okay, so if you'll notice, no commercial insurance comes close to the cost control that Medicare achieves. And that self-pay patients pay through the nose for an eye operation. This $2,100 is what the self-pay patient's going to have to pay. $619 for Medicare, maybe $1,089 for a patient with insurance. There's a huge discrepancy between what you have to pay for health care depending on who covers you. And also understand that no one is suggesting that the public be allowed to see the various insurance allowances. So my question is, why is the public being asked to choose an insurance without being given the information needed to make an informed choice? Doesn't make any sense to me. It makes a lot of sense if you're an insurance company. I feel like all of these should be out on the table and should be able to be viewed by anybody. One last thing is, even I would not, I've been doing patient billing for 10 years, even I would not feel competent to choose a medical plan because I know about ophthalmology, but I don't know how often all these other expenses are going to come up, and I don't have any good way of judging, you know, is this insurance company's allowance fair for this or not. So if I can't do it with 10 years of doing nothing but patient billing, I don't think other people are going to have a good basis of making an informed choice on which insurance plan to choose. Okay. Now if you'll turn it over, we'll take a quick look at the other side of insurance, which is insurance premiums. Who has Medicare Part B? Anybody in the room? Okay. Medicare Part B, the premium is $96.40 per month with a yearly deductible of $135. The patient pays 20% of the allowed charge, and Medicare negotiates a reduced charge based on what the physician is billing. Okay. So I want you to just see some of the others. And the next one is University of Virginia. That's my plan. I looked it up on the web. UVA pays $376 a month for a single employee's insurance. UVA pays $334 a month. The patient pays $42 a month. Now, there's no yearly deductible, and I would pay a $15 or a $30 copay. And UVA has roughly 10,000 employees. So they have a big group. They can negotiate a pretty good price. But you can see that they cannot negotiate anywhere near as good a price as Medicare was able to negotiate. I have three examples under that of just some other insurances that people have told me what their plans are, what their deductible. One person is paying $271 a month with a $5,000 calendar year deductible. Well, again, unless you know what the allowance is that insurance has negotiated with the provider, you're not going to really know how far that's going to stretch your budget or not. Another person had a $606 a month with a $2,500 calendar year deductible. And example three is this part-time trombonist non-smoker, which is me, because I went on the Aetna website, and they said for the 51-year-old man, $308 a month with a $2,500 deductible, 20% coinsurance. And when I went on the website, you had to put in all this information, and then you're given a choice of 17 or 18 different plans. That was a nightmare to go through. So that was my experiences. The thing about commercial insurance is, as you age, your rates go up. With Medicare, if you sign up when you first allowed to sign up, then your rates will go up with the whole group, but not as you age. So, again, I see Medicare seems to, time after time, protect the interest of the patient. I love Medicare. 50% of our patients are Medicare. Medicare has very clear guidelines for what's allowed and what's not allowed. There are no pre-authorizations, no referrals required. There's no out-of-network. It's like, and they pay within 20 days. You know, their computer system, it's a well-run system. Okay, so again, I'll just repeat a few of my, I tried to keep this all to one page because I could talk about this for weeks and weeks, but the brief law of insurance is that the larger the group, the less the insurance will cost because the risk is spread out. The largest group is everyone, so this is the least expensive for all. And dividing this group up into any number of commercial insurances is only going to make everyone's prices go up. And my question is, why are Medicare premiums so much less than commercial insurance premiums? Is it because our 67 to 95-year-olds are so much healthier than the rest of us? I think that may be true. What would the rates be if we included the healthier working population in amongst this group? The rates would go down for everybody. Medicare Part A has no premiums, but you pay a tax based on your wages. You pay 1.45% of your salary, and your employer pays 1.45% of your salary. And that's how Medicare Part A is funded. Now, Medicare Part A expenses and Medicare Part B expenses are roughly equal in the last year. So we're not talking about a huge amount of money. I mean, 3%, I can take a 3% tax as opposed to UVA paying $376 a month for my health insurance. Well, I could let UVA keep $100 and me keep $100, and we'd still come out ahead with a Medicare-type plan. Few final points. Any physician can keep up with one set of rules for what's allowed, what's not allowed. No physician can keep up with 30 separate sets of rules. Would you prefer your physician to practice medicine or to endlessly negotiate separate contracts and retire early because he or she is fed up with a chaotic healthcare system? That's what many physicians are doing. They're tired of it. They're leaving the practice. So to give you an example of this endless sets of rules, when I first started with ophthalmology, there was a Virginia Medicaid. You could sign up for Medicaid, and all the rules were the same. Then they added Virginia Medicaid Medallion, which was a managed care Medicaid, which had a different set of rules. Now we have contracted out 9 separate Virginia Medicaid insurance plans in Virginia, each one with its own set of rules. Each one you can get in certain counties, but you can't get in other counties. Well, surprise, some people from Orange County have to come to UVA for treatment. Some people from Madison County and Culpeper County have to come to UVA for treatment. But we're not part of their network because they're, you know, 3 of the Virginia Medicaid plans have not signed an agreement with the University of Virginia. So it's total chaos for all. Anthem has different rules for Anthem PPO products, Anthem HealthKeepers, which is an HMO product, Anthem HealthKeepers Plus, which is one of the Medicaid products, and they have another Anthem HMO product in Tidewater area, Norfolk. So each of these has different policies, different referral guidelines, different pre-authorization guidelines. University of Virginia is in network with some of the Anthem patients, but out of network with other Anthem patients. And so my question is, if one insurance company in one state has four sets of rules, how many sets of rules are there for 30 insurance companies in 50 states? Don't forget the 9 Medicaid in Virginia. I mean, there's just endless sets of rules, and that's not helping any physician. It's not helping the patient, and a lot of times the rules are designed so they can deny coverage so that the insurance saves money, but it creates a headache for the patient and the physician. Again, positive attributes of Medicare: no referrals required, no out-of-network problems, one clear set of rules, reasonable cost, and rules that protect the patient. If you come into ophthalmology for something that the ophthalmologist knows is not covered by Medicare, we have to have you sign a waiver prior to doing the procedure saying, we're making you understand this is not covered by Medicare, you will be responsible for the cost, and we have to tell you what the cost is. If we don't do that, Medicare will deny and we're not allowed to bill the patient. I think this is correct. If we're going to do something that, given one set of guidelines, if we're going to do something that Medicare won't allow, we should have the courtesy to tell the patient what it's going to cost and that they will be responsible. That makes perfect sense to me. Again, I hear no voices in the mainstream media that represent my best interest. I hear many voices, often disguised, that represent the interest of the insurance company and the pharmaceutical industry. And my final thing is, I believe that we are being sold fear. When you hear a message that makes you fearful, ask yourself what the messenger has to gain from your fear, and then make your decision accordingly. So that concludes my presentation. Thank you.
Now, David Shreve will broaden our perspective even further by looking at the economics of the healthcare system, not just from the provider's point of view or the patient's point of view, but from our national point of view. Thank you.
Thank you, Bob. And indeed, let me start with a disclosure so that you know where I'm headed with this brief talk. I am a proponent of a single-payer system. Now, to the gentleman who asked the question about what that means, I think when I get down to the third part of my discussion, I'll address at least part of that question, and because it is a very good question. Single-payer can take many, many forms. There are many possible iterations. The one thing I might say at the outset is that one of the things I've learned that we ignore at our peril here in the United States is when we make the assumption that we have to necessarily borrow from a Canada or from a European plan or some model that exists somewhere else in the world, we forget about distinguishing characteristics here at home that give us a leg up on some of these countries. Our wealth, the notion that much of medical technology and innovation has taken place here in this country for a lot of different reasons. So in many ways, you might say, in my opinion, that we don't have to settle for the Canadian plan or the German plan or any other plan like that. And as you'll see, I think, when I swing around to talk about what single payer might well mean, to me it means one thing in particular, and that is how you pay for it, and little else. What I'll do is I'll break down my talk into three sections. And I will focus on single payer, but keep in mind that what I have to say about this essentially reflects on the system as a whole. And I think you'll, if I do this clearly enough, you'll see that what I'm posing is an analysis, economic analysis, of the major options before us. One being the status quo, do nothing, just kind of limp along and put our finger in the dike and do the best we can with maybe things like SCHIP expansion and covering more people under Medicaid and tweaking Medicare, and then doing something with our private insurers in terms of how they cover patients and how they bill, and maybe electronic medical records will have some decent and sufficient breakthroughs there, et cetera. The other option would be something like we're going to see in a very short time coming from Washington, D.C. The best way to characterize that option would probably be to say that it's built on what some are calling the Massachusetts model, something anyway that involves some kind of employer or citizen mandate to be covered with subsidies. Now, how you pay for these subsidies is open to question, and in my opinion, the answers we're getting to the question of how you pay that, those subsidies are not reflective of our best possible approaches there, even in that regard. But then the third option would be some kind of a single-payer system, the kind that I think we must move toward even in the short run. Now, why single-payer? If you look at how it would fare politically and economically versus this option that we're likely to see being proposed by Congress and the Obama administration, one of the things they're counting on, I think, is what historians and political scientists refer to as the salami slicing model of politics. That is, that you get the foot in the door, you get a program that does a little bit of what you want, and then over the years you add to it. And this was the vision of somebody like Wilbur Cohen, for example, one of the persons most responsible for driving home the lobbying effort on behalf of Medicaid and Medicare, and finally seeing that come to pass in the 1960s after about 20 years of political struggle. And Cohen's vision, when he left the Johnson administration in 1969, that Medicare would indeed, and Medicaid, would indeed be a model for a movement, a greater movement toward national health insurance. Now, we've seen what's come to pass since 1969, and it's not quite what Wilbur Cohen envisioned. Why is that? And I think this is something we need to know as we go into this debate. I think that what happened significantly was in the post-Watergate congressional reform era, that is, where we were allegedly introducing democratic reforms to the way Congress operated and the way the presidency operated, et cetera. We actually de-emphasized the role of committee chairman, put more power in the hands of subcommittees, put more power in the hands of congressmen who had special interests, in a good sense, I don't mean this in a negative sense, for certain categories of the overall general legislation they often heard or considered. And what that implied, unfortunately, I think, besides increasing little d democracy on one hand, was that it opened the door for the greater influence of lobbyists. And it also made it more difficult for what I would consider general reform legislation to pass through the wickets, because everybody has their little fiefdom now, and they're concerned with, and the very knowledgeable people are involved. And when I say lobbyists getting involved here, I don't necessarily imply that that's negative either. We have good and bad lobbyists, and the good ones are the ones who bring a lot of knowledge and experience to the table, and we get a lot of that. But it's a case in some ways. I think the best way to sum this up is we're not often seeing the forest for the trees. And it's I think, a direct result of that reform. What that tells me is that the salami slicing model may not work now as it did in the New Deal, Great Society years, when it appeared possible that we could kind of move to inch toward a more general reform from smaller specific reforms. Word of caution there. Inapplicability of the Massachusetts model. I think some of the things we're overlooking when we look at this notion of employer or citizen mandates, and you cite Massachusetts or another state where they're experimenting with this, is that in that particular case, they have a relatively low rate of uninsured population, low levels of cross-subsidy, that is, borrowing from one payment system to shore up another, high median income. I think the other thing that we overlook is this historical trend in all of these places, where one reason we've had a steady decline on employer-funded insurance since the late 1980s is a slow squeeze on labor. And what this means, or what this should imply, in other words, is that if we're counting on a kind of a mandate for employers or citizens to step up and insure themselves, with subsidies, of course, we're counting on a system where the individuals involved in this have less ability to do that. I think we've seen, and it's not just a function of recent cost explosion, it's something that's been going on for about two or three decades now. I won't reiterate the insurance principle of using the largest possible risk pool, because my predecessors, I think, explained that pretty well, but I think this ought to come into play as well. This was the genesis of the Blue Cross system. The hospitals that created the Blue Cross system did so because what they began to see quickly was what we call cherry picking, that there was competition among hospitals for the healthiest, least expensive patients, and it wasn't working to the benefit of anyone. That happened quite early in the building up of our healthcare system. I'm surprised that some 60, 70 years later, we still haven't learned that lesson, that to have the largest possible risk pool is an absolute must and a certainty for any kind of a system that we want to design. The only logical way, as I see it, of moving in that direction is a single-payer system. And then the other principle that I think suggests that we must consider a single-payer system is that if we look at the most recent and I think accurate studies of the cost explosion, one thing stands out, and that is that despite the presence of real administrative costs that we shouldn't be bearing and the kinds of things that we've heard recently in the previous discussions about one health plan versus another and how complex it can be, that's important. But beyond that, what we've noticed in a lot of these good analyses is that we're wasting a lot of our healthcare dollars. And we're wasting it for one particular reason, and that is that we ration more and more. And fortunately, in some areas, some regions, not as much as others, but more and more, we're rationing on the basis of what can turn a profit. And if you do that, that's a slippery slope, I think, past, you know, on which we cannot reside. We cannot sustain any kind of a healthcare system in this country if that becomes the model more and more and more. And it is. We're seeing that clearly in more and more of the analyses that look at the cost explosion. I would refer you to the New Yorker magazine, June 1st issue. A physician by the name of Atul Gawande undertook an interesting analysis in which he tried to find out, looking at Medicare payments and costs, where it was the most expensive. And he found out that, of all places, it's McAllen, Texas. Now, Miami was a little bit higher, but Miami's an outlier because it has an expensive cost of living there. But beyond Miami, it was McAllen, Texas. And when he started drilling down for the reasons why this was the case, it was because in that area, the physicians had taken it upon themselves, relative to other places, to do more for-profit intermediary care and referrals to their own labs that they owned and so on and so forth. It happens everywhere to some extent, but this was a bit of an outlier and it jumped out at him when he looked at the statistics. So this is a real problem. Now, why not single payer? Are there good reasons why we should not look at it? And in particular, maybe the single payer version that is being promoted readily today, and that is H.R. 676, Medicare for All, sponsored by Congressman John Conyers of Michigan. Yes, I think there are some reasons. Number one, in my mind, is that H.R. 676 has a poorly structured financing mechanism. It is dominated by a new tax, 3.3% payroll tax, which would be added to the 1.45% Medicare payroll tax that folks already pay. Now, we've improved this vehicle a little bit. Some of you may remember, but prior to 1990, before President Bush 41 instituted this change, the Medicare tax was a lot like the Social Security retirement tax, and that was that there was a cap, that you only paid on so much of your income, and then you stopped paying that tax. Well, in 90, they moved to raise that cap higher than the regular Social Security payroll tax. I believe it was $125,000 in income at that point. And then in the 93 budget reconciliation in the Clinton administration, they removed it altogether. So in some ways, that vehicle works better than it did because it applies to everyone, and it's more universally applied. What that means is that the rate can be lower for everyone because it's spread out. Nonetheless, it's a flat rate. It doesn't keep pace with expenses very well. It's a poor way to finance anything, let alone health care. And as such, it's still somewhat regressive, which means that, I think the assumption is, again, maybe going back to the salami slicing model, that there's no other way to do this. This is the way we've always paid for this kind of program. Politically, maybe it's the only way. And I think that's very nearsighted, and that what we ought to consider are better ways to pay for a program that we really need. It falls victim to what I consider the common tax structure malady that we see all over the place, and that is that we have this tendency to pair or want to pair revenues with spending in close proximity. So there, for instance, we considered paying for the SCHIP, the Children's Health Insurance Program extension, with a tobacco tax, seeing that somehow, well, tobacco tax is a kind of a health care measure. It reduces smoking. It has proven itself worthy in that regard. But as a revenue measure, it's extremely regressive. It falls disproportionately on the poorest of our citizens. And if it works to raise any revenue or to do its job, rather, that is to convince people to stop smoking, the revenues will go down, not up. Why would you want to pin or tie an important spending program that you want and that you want to keep for some time on a revenue measure that doesn't keep pace like that? It's just the wrong way to go. The other tendency we have is if failing that kind of a thing, which is akin to a user fee, we resort to either a soak the rich scheme, that is, let's just put something on rich people and let them pay for it all, or on corporations without really considering whether this corporate tax is regressive, flat, progressive. We simply assume that because it's on corporations, corporations can afford it. They're bigger, they're stronger, they're wealthier than all of us. And what we end up with a lot of times are very regressive corporate tax measures as well. So I think we need to be smarter about financing. And unfortunately, I'm here to tell you that the way they put together H.R. 676 in terms of the financing was not very smart. I think it's the principal Achilles heel. You'll hear a lot of talk about why we don't want single payer because it's socialized medicine, because it'll give the government too much power, et cetera, et cetera. I think these are all red herrings. I don't think that when push comes to shove, if people really consider it closely, that those things will matter that much. But what does is how you pay for it. And I don't think it's set up in a good way. Now, the last thing I want to illustrate or talk about as an example of, I'm begging the question here, well, then how would you pay for something like this? And what I'll do is I'll list some things, and if you can follow them, great. If not, what I will do is, after listing these items, I will tote them up for you and mention a few subtotals and totals so you get the general picture of what this implies. And remember, and this goes back to the question that was asked earlier about single payer, that what we're talking about here is simply a new way to pay for healthcare, not a new way to administer it. There are many possibilities there, and I do think that a move to single payer would enable some of these new possibilities for administration, more efficient, but also kind of an administration inclined more toward healthcare rather than profits to the benefit of all. What are we talking about? We're projected to spend nationally on healthcare about $2.3 trillion in the next year or so. Of that total, we already spend about $1.1 trillion in the Medicare and the Medicaid programs. And by the way, the $2.3 trillion figure does exclude elective plastic surgery and over-the-counter medicine, so those aren't thrown in. But everything else, $2.3 trillion. This $1.1 trillion figure, I should introduce one caveat, is actually my subtotal of the current amount, which is a little bit higher, that calls for 85% maintenance of effort on the part of state governments. One of the things also built into H.R. 676 is what they call 100% maintenance of effort by state governments. This means that what the state of Virginia pays as its portion of the Medicaid program would be sustained. And I think states are in such a position, partly because of their goofy financing structure, witness California in particular, where they cannot sustain even what they pay now in Medicaid. So I would, I'm building a model based on 85% maintenance of effort. That is, giving states a little break. And I think politically this would be smart, because if you could get 50 governors behind any plan, it's going to have a lot more steam than something that doesn't work with the states as readily. Now, we've also got about $200 billion currently in the system that we spend for tax benefits on medical expenditures, that is deductions, et cetera, for individuals and employers who make healthcare expenditures on behalf of themselves or their companies or their employers. So that's already built into the system as well. If you have a single payer system, you don't need that. You don't need to spend that $200 billion. So you can back that off immediately. Now, what it amounts to then is what we really need to find is $1 trillion, above and beyond what we spend on existing government programs, using those tax deductions, backing those out. We need another $1 trillion. Here's a short list of one way to do that, I think, without raising a single tax rate. Treat capital gains as regular income, $100 billion. Police overseas tax evasion, $100 billion. End stepped-up basis of capital gains at death, $70 billion. Change existing mortgage interest deduction, credit with a cap instead of the open-ended system that we have now, and lower capital gains exclusion, not eliminating it, but just reducing it from the $500,000, say, to $300,000. That's worth about $60 billion. Repeal accelerated depreciation, $50 billion. Phase out the child tax credit for wealthy individuals. In other words, put a cap on that as well. That's worth about $25 billion. Eliminate subsidies for executive compensation over $1 million. Most people don't know that built into our tax structure are subsidies for those salaries that are unlimited. If you capped it at $1 million, we could save about $20 billion in revenue. And what I call the Grover Norquist Amendment for sales tax deductions. A couple of years ago, Norquist lobbied heavily for a new provision under which states that don't have an income tax, and there are nine of these, whose citizens, because they don't have an income tax, therefore could not deduct that on their personal returns, federal returns, got a new deduction that they could choose as an option, that is for the sales tax they paid. That costs us about $12 billion a year. I think it was unnecessary. It was a way to stave off more sensible tax reform in those states, and I think we could well do without it. Now, you add all that up, and it's come to about $687 billion. So that takes you about two-thirds of the way toward that trillion. If you look at what a single-payer system would do in terms of administrative savings, savings on equipment and drugs, and savings from lower malpractice suits and premiums, one of the things, for example, we know from looking at just the Canadian system, whether we want that or not, one of the things we do know is that their malpractice premiums are about half what ours are. The principal reason appears to be that because their citizens don't go bankrupt when they have medical problems, they're less inclined to sue. They may have medical problems similar to ours as a result of malpractice. They may be upset. They may, you know, and there are plenty of suits, but it appears that that added ingredient of going bankrupt and losing a lot of money when you have medical problems brings you to the point of wanting to sue more readily. So for that reason alone, it appears that we could probably save about $30 billion. Our overall bill in that regard is $60 billion today. We could probably save about half. If you factor in the administrative savings, estimated to be conservatively around $200 billion, savings on equipment and drugs, conservatively estimated to be about $150 billion, you're already there at the $1 trillion expenditure without really raising a single tax rate. Now, if you wanted to be take a conservative approach to budgeting, pay as you go, and make sure that we pay for every single dollar, I don't think we should necessarily. We should have deficit spending at times, such as now, and there's no reason if it's a national priority that we can't subsidize this with a little deficit spending. But if you really wanted that and you saw that you needed small tax increases, there are some reasonable ones available. Now, this is one tax component that is in H.R. 676 that I endorse because I think it's a good measure in and of itself, and that is a small transaction tax on stock market securities transactions. The original proposal had it at 0.25%. The latest proposal, I noticed they upped it to 0.33%. I would suggest that you could probably go with 0.125%. 0.25% would raise approximately, where's the figure I have? $145 billion. So let's say you fell a little bit short of that $1 trillion figure to pay for this. You could get $145 billion effortlessly in that regard. There are, of course, proposals in the current Obama budget to roll back some of the Bush tax cuts. $50 billion worth in their proposal. If you rolled them all back, which I might not recommend, but if you wanted to do that, that's worth about $210 billion. So there's plenty of money here in the system, I think, without going to a new payroll tax. That's my basic point. And we're not even to the point in the discussion where we talk about just how much we waste based on that McAllen example that Dr. Gawande came up with. Tim Garson and Carolyn Engelhard at UVA estimate that number could be as high as $650 billion nationwide that we spend and waste and get nothing for. So bottom line, I don't think we should ignore single payer as an option because we deem it too expensive. I think we should consider it because the other options are probably too expensive. Thanks.
Now we have time left for some questions, and the gentleman here will have a microphone. Please speak into the microphone so that your question will be recorded for the podcast. Also, when you start your question, please tell us how you are covered by insurance. For example, my job got cut last November, I've had to get individual health insurance, and I'm covered through an Aetna policy with a $2,500 deductible. So if you'll go to the first questioner, the gentleman over there. And to whom do you want to direct your question on the panel?
I would like to address my question to the panel. I am covered by Medicare and the Anthem Supplementary. I'm a retired government employee. My question is this. Medicare is currently broke. How in the world can we add to Medicare for everybody without raising taxes? I am very disturbed by your comment by taxing the people who are capitalists and companies that are overseas or special groups. Thank you very much.
David, do you want to address that first?
Is this on?
Yeah.
Well, first of all, the Medicare is not broke. The projections that we have for the trust fund expenditures and what we're paying out and what we're taking in have two basic flaws. One is that the projections, and they are projections, we don't know, of course, where we're headed economically, and we don't know what kind of revenues will come in and what our expenditures will look like. But the expenditures are based on what I would consider extremely pessimistic assumptions about our economy. And the way I would sum it up is to say is if those projections are correct, well, not only is our health care system lost, Medicare included, but so is the whole economy. So we've got bigger problems if they're than just health care and Medicare, if they're correct. I don't think they are. If you build in, well, let me say this. There's no reason we should not have something approximating full employment all the time. We know how to do it. We have the experience and knowledge to keep on that kind of a pace. If you had that, if you had something approximating that, around 4% unemployment, then this financing problem goes away immediately. We can finance it infinitely. That's true for Social Security as it is for Medicare. Now, it's true that the track we're on the expenditure side, is going to be burdensome. So that's why we're here today, to tell you about ways that we think we can bring new efficiencies to the system. And then I'll close by, I think what you were referring to when you talked about the tax measures were taxing capitalists and people overseas. I mentioned overseas tax havens and tax evasion and the amount that we could draw out of that. In every case that I cited, these measures are represent one of two things. That is, a kind of a subsidy that we pay, whether it's giving somebody deductibility or accelerated appreciation or whatnot, where we've expected some gain in economic efficiency or productivity as a result. And my analysis suggests that the ones I've listed here give us none of that. Okay, that's one example. The other is outright evasion and fraud, and I don't think anybody can be for that. I think everybody should pay their fair share. I believe what Oliver Wendell Holmes Jr. said about taxes.
I'm for evasion.
No, you're for evasion? Okay, yeah. Is the way we ought to approach it, and that is that taxes are the price we pay for civilization. And if we want civilization, we should all pay a little something.
Can I briefly respond?
Briefly.
I'll tell you one very quick way that we can get Medicare more solvent. If Medicare can negotiate a $619 price for a $2,100 cataract surgery, it boggles my mind why they don't negotiate a price for drugs, and why Americans have to pay more than citizens of any other country in the world for drugs. It makes no sense to me.
I think I have it. I'm very fortunate. I have Medicare and Express, TRICARE for Life, the military, so I'm doing pretty well. I'm just wondering, if other people have had happen to them just what happened to me yesterday. I received a letter yesterday from a group of physicians that I've been going to for 15 years stating that if by 2010 Medicare doesn't increase the monies coming to the physicians, they will drop their Medicare patients. Have you heard of this happening to other people?
This involves the something we unfortunately dodged up here on the panel, and that is the issue of cross subsidies. It's possible to say what Robert has talked about, and that is that Medicare is a bit more efficient and cheaper, and they negotiate better rates. But it's also possible, and I don't think this is the case necessarily, but it's also possible to say, well, the only reason Medicare can do that is because we're using cross subsidies. Somebody else is paying for that. They're underpaying. And then the others that are paying more are, in a hidden way, carrying the freight. And so that could be one reason you're seeing this phenomenon, that is doctors dropping Medicare patients because they see that, well, I can't afford to see them. My costs are such that rate just doesn't cover it. Now, as Robert pointed out, these rates are negotiating in a way where they use a pretty firm analysis of what costs should be. What's hidden, however, is not so much the cross subsidy, but the heavy administrative costs that are tied to a fragmented system. So yes, there are many doctors who are in a position where they cannot afford to accept a certain kind of a low payment for services rendered. But I would attest to you, suggest to you that for the most part, that's because of the fragmented system and the costs directly related to that, not to what it would really cost to deliver health care in a unified model.
Okay, next.
What insurance do I have? I'm self-insured, and I'm debating right now whether to stay with the $5,700 deductible that covers 80% up to $10,000 out of pocket, or go for the full $10,000 deductible with $10,000 out of pocket. So it's kind of funny. I'm also helping some friends who have a friend who has terminal cancer, lost her job, then lost her insurance, and is trying to get Medicaid but has to spend down retirement funds so they can get poor enough to get Medicaid. But anyway, in the analysis of what it would cost, you use $1 trillion outside of Medicare and Medicaid. What portion of that is directly attributed to profits of private insurance companies and the marketing costs, et cetera, et cetera? My question directly is, how much money is out there that we're talking about taking away from people who are making it?
There's probably two questions implicit in your comments. One is related to the dollar figures, what's out there. And I think a good rule of thumb would be to look at three categories that I mentioned. That is administrative cost savings that would potentially come with a single payer, around $200 billion. Equipment and pharmaceutical savings, $150 billion, so that's $350 billion total. And then some measure of that $650 billion waste figure cited by Tim Garson and Carolyn. Not all of it, certainly, but a good portion of it. So we're probably looking at 35 to 40% of our overall healthcare bill. Now, as an economist who doesn't always look just at healthcare issues, one of the things I've tried to encourage policymaker and analyst friends to consider is that in some ways, healthcare expenditures, however efficient or inefficient they have become, were a big part of our jobs program over the last 15 or 20 years. There's two major areas where jobs have grown, and this is before this recession hit. So even, you know, during going back to the 90s boom and good times and modest times over the last 20, 25 years, two categories, healthcare and government, teachers, policemen, et cetera, public safety workers, right on down the line. So I think what you were implying is if we become too efficient, aren't we going to throw people out of work or reduce profitability in some of these entities to the point where they're going to have to lay off workers or pay them less, et cetera, et cetera? Yes, I think if done, and this is single payer wouldn't imply this, but ultimately would have to, and that is healthcare system is going to be about rationing. So you've got to ration it one way or another. If we ration it continually on the basis, as we do it now, on where profit lies, then we'll get an unequal and inefficient system, and it'll become even more unequal and inefficient as we go on. If we do it the other way around, I think we stand a pretty good chance, not a perfect chance ever, but a pretty good chance of rationing it on the basis of healthcare and squeezing profit out of the system, because it is profit, as you say, among those entities who can afford to take a little bit less. That's all you can do. That's all you can do.
Okay. Marvin has suggested that although our time for the meeting usually ends at 3 o'clock, that we will continue until about 3:15 so we can accommodate more questions. And so anyone who would like to hang around and keep on drilling the questions to the panelists here, welcome to do so. And you, sir?
I recently had the opportunity to spend 3 nights in a local hospital, and I just happened to have the statement that came in recently. And the bill was $26,587. That's the gross amount, discounted by $15,633. Well, I suggest to you that in the business that I ran, if I presented bills like that, I would have been put out of business for fraud. But that aside, the real question is, When we talk about expenditures for health care, what are we talking about, the $26,000 or the $15,000?
The $15,000. That's a good question. I remember years ago when I was an analyst for the state of Louisiana, we heard a lot of state legislators, this was back in the early 1990s, talk about how we've, and we had a, I should say, a unique system there, where we had a 10-hospital charity hospital network where we covered most of the state's uninsured. It's a unique system. No other state has it. These are state-owned acute care hospitals. But what they had recognized in these acute care hospitals about 30 years ago was that a lot of people were using the ERs as clinics. They were just showing up because they had no other place to go. And so they began to rationalize the way they approached the ER care, and they had a triage set up where, you know, the most emergent, of course, went one way and the least emergent went another. And they actually set up real clinics in the ERs. And what I began hearing a lot from legislators is we've got to stop this flow of patients, uninsured patients to the emergency room. It's costing us too much. And what they were looking at was the charge for the ER, not the cost. There is a difference. And when I started to analyze what the cost was, lo and behold, because these acute care hospitals stayed open 24 hours and weekends, and because they were counted on for the care of most of the state's uninsured, they were actually more efficient places to get the clinical care. It was cheaper. You know, it went against what a lot of people believed about emergency room care, that it was just more costly. Well, if you looked at charges, yes, but that didn't reflect cost. So the $15,000 is the real figure. That's the cost. Now, in a way, it's not really the real cost because they're fudging that as well. It's based on constitutes a system where there are cross subsidies included. So they're getting money from different piles and different areas. And most of the accountants, I would argue, in the system that come up with that figure, both figures, the higher and the lower, really don't know what they represent. It's a guess. And I think one of the unfortunate things about our system is that we are doomed to do too much guesswork. You're always going to have some, but we do way too much.
That difference in the charge, I had the same thing. I had blood work done. Charge were $400. They had negotiated a contract with the insurance for $100, and I had to pay $10. So I wish that our population would start looking at health care the way that they obviously recognize you've got to have some legislation for used car sales. Nobody objects when there are consumer protection laws to protect somebody buying a used car. I don't understand why there can't be some consumer protection laws for patients so that they're not charged unreasonable amounts. What's happened is that hospital gets a certain amount from Medicare, and they negotiate a certain amount higher from the insurances, and they make the majority of their profits from the self-insured patients. And I think fundamentally as a society, that's a primitive way for us to exist. And I would hope that we could evolve to the point that we cooperate to produce a system that serves both the healthcare providers, who are the most highly trained people in the industry, as well as the patients, that works for the good of all. That's my hope.
I have a $10,000 deductible policy. My question has to do with the supply of nurses and doctors. Still getting used to this. And do you have any thoughts on how we can keep that supply going? In particular, would it make sense to subsidize the education of nurses and doctors in order to ensure a supply?
We've done it before. We did it in the 1960s, and it worked, and it can work again. I served on a couple of several dissertation committees in the School of Nursing, and one of the studies on which I served was a young man in the program who had done a doctoral dissertation on the building up of the UVA hospital in the 1940s and 50s. And one of the things that he discovered, and I'm not telling this perfectly accurately, but it's at least I'll hit the general outlines, was that when they put together the first budgets and they were getting federal funds through what was called the Hill-Burton program to expand services and build up the hospital, one of the things they discovered as they worked through their first budgets was, oh my God, we forgot to factor in nursing care here. You know, mostly male doctors were running the show, and the nurses were invisible, essentially, is what it amounted to. It was like they weren't there. And so it took them a few weeks to, like, this doesn't seem right. What's missing? And, oh, nursing care, yes. And they had to go back and, of course, and redo the whole budgets. But I think that's the source of part of the problem on that side, on the nursing side, that still, by and large, they're too invisible in the system and don't have as much power and control. And if they did, we wouldn't have, it's kind of a sinusoidal wave approach now where we wait until the supply problem becomes chronic, and then we patch together a program, and then everybody rushes in, and then it launches upward, and then people start to become afraid that we'll have too many, and they back down, and, you know, up and down and up and down. We've done less of that with physicians, but we need to subsidize it. Yeah.
Okay. Nobody is really addressing the issue of what's the most cost-effective way to have health care. The most cost-effective way is that you find the least expensive modes of health care. Everybody probably has a car, you know. You don't always go to the dealership when you need your oil changed. Nobody's looking. It's the same thing in healthcare. There are a lot of things that can be done by nurses, nurse practitioners, but there is nobody who has money invested in a more efficient healthcare system in terms of the least cost for the most care. That is not being addressed.
My name is Alan Young, and I'm a registered nurse at one of our local hospitals. I work in the cardiology department, and I used to be a lab technician. I went back to UVA for a second degree program and paid for my own tuition. I got a small scholarship, but it cost me about $5,000. So I'd be very much in favor of what you folks are talking about for the subsidies. But I worked in the emergency room and in cardiology at one of the local hospitals. So I've seen firsthand the effect of our broken healthcare system, where people come to the emergency room when they have put off problems because they can't afford to go to the doctor. And so it's a big crisis, it's a big pain, big problem, and they come in. I just want to make a comment, and that's that in the next few weeks and months, there's going to be a big debate on the healthcare system. You're going to hear a lot from our senators. I think it's important to keep in mind that our senators are heavily subsidized. Many of them are heavily subsidized by the lobbyists in the healthcare industry. So take what they say. You know, if they're against the public option payment assistance program, with a grain of salt. And the second thing is to think, where is their insurance coming from, the senators? And if they're arguing against the public option, do you think they're paying for Blue Cross and Blue Shield? You know, it's the their government employee public option healthcare benefit, persons who benefit. That's all.
Is this on? To follow up what you just said, I think regardless of what your position is, on my little small orange or green sheet of paper are the phone numbers for Tom Perriello, congressman for the 5th District, and our two senators and the president. Call them and weigh in, regardless of your position. Because until we talk to them, they're not going to change. What I'm seeing, having involved myself in the topic, is that right now that the jaws of profit are securely on Washington, D.C., securely clamped. and that's why single payer was left out of the room until literally some doctors were arrested. And this is what democracy is about. We've got to make them do something. So I would encourage you to keep that little piece of paper, either go to their website, send them an email, write them a letter, or phone them and let them know how you feel.
The point I was making about the post-Watergate reforms as well is that I think our politicians, unfortunately, are less well-positioned to take on this kind of a reform effort in looking at the big picture, looking at the whole. So in some ways, it's the system as well as the politicians themselves. Gone are the day, unfortunately, where we had a guy like Jesse Unruh. If any of you ever lived in California, you may remember him as the powerful Speaker of the House there. He was quoted one time as saying, he's talking about lobbyists, if you can't take their money and drink their booze and eat their food and vote against them the next day, then you don't belong being here in the House. So it's harder and harder for our politicians to be like that.
I'm on Social Security and covered by Cigna as my supplement. Since we're all eligible for Social Security at 65, what adjustments would have to be made in order to lower that to birth for eligibility, for Social Security, for Medicare?
Age at which you're eligible?
From 65 to zero, to at birth. What adjustments would have to be made?
This is really what I was speaking to in terms of a single payer system. That's, folded all in into under one umbrella, and it would, cost you an additional $1 trillion, and so you'd have to figure out how to pay for it.
Also, I would say that if you're take all the money that employers and employees are already spending on health care and put that into a system, you'll get far more health care for your dollar. So everybody will save, and it just seems the way to go to me.
That's the $200 billion I mentioned earlier.
Right.
Okay, one more.
We've heard from people who have a $10,000 deductible and all these things. Nobody's mentioned 46 million people who are uninsured. Nobody's mentioned the fact that no other country, socialist or otherwise, has people going bankrupt and losing their homes. How about the morality of that? And it seemed I was going to ask if single payer would bankrupt the country. And then Mr. Graham presented that wonderful handout, and it seems to me it's a no-brainer that Medicare is far more efficient than the for-profit. And you talk about commercial companies. Come on, it's for-profit. One of the executives gets $24 million a year. I'm sure the head of Medicare doesn't make that kind of money. So, I mean, as a Christian nation, shouldn't we make sure that everybody has a right to decent health care?
I'd like to make a quick response to that. I didn't talk about the morality of that because there is no morality to that situation. So there was no morality to talk about. And I agree with you completely.
I wanted to just ask one quick thing. What about all the illegal aliens that we're trying to give health care to? That's affecting our health care and our system when we're trying to take care of everybody and they're coming into this country to get the free health care.
As looking at it from a purely economic perspective, the problem with illegal entry is more a jobs problem than a financial problem. And what it amounts to is the use of workers from other countries, some documented, many not, who undercut wages in this country. Now, that's a separate problem. If you do a balance sheet approach to it, though, and you look at what they contribute to the Social Security stream, for example, as to and compare it to what is taken out. There's probably a net gain for having employed these people. So that's not to say that it's the right way to go, especially considering those labor force problems. But it's not costing us. It's not costing us.
Thank our panel. I was impressed before today with the knowledge that I was picking up in our conversations as an ad hoc committee. Now, after today, I am awed by the amount of knowledge that these gentlemen and this lady have, and I want to thank them for participating today.
For the Charlottesville Podcasting Network, I'm Dan Daniels.